So thank you so much. Thank you to Yvonne for that amazing welcome to the country. And Trevor's and the whole staff of CPD who've choreographed an amazing week for me, very busy but very inspiring. And to John and Susie, I haven't met you yet, but I hope that we will meet very soon right after the talk and we can exchange ideas about this great topic. Is it up there? Yes, it is. Good. And, you know, it's interesting the pressure actually we put on states. You know, can the state deliver? When actually there's so many problems across different actors in society. Just think of the financial crisis and what that exposed of the difficulties across both finance and business. And so I think that perhaps the reason that sometimes I look scary is because, actually, I don't think I look scary at all there. Bill Gates looks a bit scarier than me, I'm not sure. But anyway, is precisely this, provocation to make sure that we're putting equal pressure on the different partners, right, in society, so including civil society, you know, trade unions, different types of businesses, their governance structures, the financial sector, is it actually doing its job? And of course, the state. And one of the interesting things is that because we've actually often dismissed the state in terms of its ability to create value, the words we use that I'll talk about in a minute are often quite boring. You know, the state is just about enabling and facilitating and fixing things. Then perhaps we also haven't structured our state institutions, which are really kind of a decentralized network of different institutions, including our public broadcasters like ABC. And I had a very good time yesterday with Laura Tingle, but we were both a bit peed off that cricket somehow got in the way of our long, deep discussion. Anyway, we'll talk about that later, perhaps. But, you know, actually things are quite scary in terms of, and I don't like the word scary because many of these things that are worrying, like climate change, could actually be seen as an opportunity. But, you know, it is quite scary. So if you've read the IPCC report of the International Group on Climate Change, apparently we just have 12 years left in terms of when things are going to get extremely bad. I mean, we've already seen across the world, and Australia, of course, is very concerned about this because of the geography of the country. But, you know, instead of thinking of it as, you know, in terms of being scary, what could this actually present to us in terms of new investment opportunities, seeing these problems, and just think of all the sustainable development goals, 17 of them. There's 17 goals that over 100 countries have signed up to. Underneath them, there's about 169 targets. How are we actually going to get there? And of course, we will only get there in terms of solving these problems in partnership. So different types of public actors, different types of businesses, the financial sector, again, properly doing its job, but also social movements, which have always historically been critical to the shaping of markets under capitalism. We should never forget what trade unions brought us in terms of making sure that markets have been more inclusive and sustainable in the real sense of the word. So, you know, even just having weekends and 8-hour workdays and construction workers who have construction hats, that was actually fought for by people. So what, you know, how can we together actually tackle these difficult problems? So that's what I want to talk about tonight. I'll get to the issue of the state, but first just to kind of remember that it's not just the state that has to deliver, but these other actors as well. One of the big problems that, of course, the financial crisis revealed is just how dysfunctional in some ways the financial sector had become or has become. We shouldn't forget that at one time, you know, the financial sector even had words like chemical bank. So there was banks that were actually directly fueling growth within the real economy. So in that case, it was the chemical industry, which isn't necessarily a good thing or bad thing. Kind of depends what was happening in the chemical industry. But there was a much more direct relationship between how finance saw its role and what we call the real economy. Just think of how industries are operating and then how work is being structured and how technological change occurs in those industries. And the two things have gotten quite divorced. And this graph here, which is by Andy Haldane, who's the chief economist in the Bank of England, just shows just how much, this is data for the UK, but in the US it was even worse, just how much finance kind of just ended up getting a logic of its own. This shows the growth of financial intermediation. That's that top dotted line compared to the rest of the economy. So in terms of gross value added in the economy, think of everything else that happens besides finance. I think agriculture is also not included there. And that's basically because finance has basically been financing finance, so other parts of the financial sector. We sometimes call that FIRE, finance, insurance, and real estate. And that's one side of what we call the financialization problem. Another side of the financialization problem is just how much industry itself, which maybe hasn't had, again, this direct relationship with finance, but industry itself has become financialized. So these pressures around maximizing shareholder value has actually made lots of industries kind of forget, again, what the whole point is of running a company, and increasingly use their income, so profits, not to be reinvested back into production in terms of, you know, investing in human capital, so workers, training programs, machinery, and the different things that happen at work, but just in doing things like buying back their own shares. So buying back your shares, which increases stock prices, stock options, and surprise, surprise, executive pay. And this, by the way, is getting even worse over time. So Apple, under Steve Jobs, basically most of the profits were reinvested back in the company, especially around the whole issue of design. That's one of the big things that Apple has been very good at, more than R&D. I'll get to that later. And recently under Tim Cook, you know, massive share buyback schemes of the amount of close to $100 billion. And this, by the way, is probably one of the biggest problems in terms of work. There's all this talk about the robots are coming, the robots are going to take, you know, jobs away, and wages are going to fall because of that. And it's quite interesting that when you go back in the history of economic thought, you find that lots of thinkers actually were already talking about that 200 years ago. So David Ricardo, who's one of the first economists, kind of proper economists, who actually wrote a textbook called Principles of Political Economy, he had a chapter called On Machinery. It was chapter 31. He wrote that book in 1821. It's incredible how I remember these things. I forget everyone's names and all the kind of things I did yesterday, but you know, chapter 31, 1821. Wow. Anyway, and he was worried about exactly that. You know, this mechanization that he was witnessing during the Industrial Revolution was in fact taking jobs. And what we saw then for about 200 years was that in fact there was this kind of natural thing that was happening, that often mechanization did in fact displace labor. So that's not new. Why are we talking about this so much today? What is new is this stuff. So when profits stop getting reinvested back in the economy, of course that's bad for jobs. Because what used to happen was that even though machine A would be introduced and perhaps take jobs, as long as the profits were then reinvested in another part of the economy, those jobs lost actually then appeared elsewhere. As well as workers being invested in, if profits were also being reinvested in human capital, their ability also to adjust to big, adapt to big changes was greater. And it's quite interesting how this kind of is ignored in this whole debate about what's going to happen to jobs under work. Anyway, so this is a huge problem. And in fact, you also see this at the macroeconomic level. You see it in terms of this lack of reinvestment, in terms of the falling levels of investment, which you can see both in terms of fixed capital investment. You also see it in terms of R&D expenditures, so especially the ratio of these share buybacks over R&D, which is a good proxy of the investments that companies are making and actually improving long-run growth. That's getting worse. So this is the context, really, I think, of tonight's discussion of can the state deliver? Because the quick answer is, of course not. Because how can the state or any of these actors not deliver together, again, to tackle these really big global challenges that also have national ramifications, whether they be challenges around inequality, challenges around climate change, challenges around, in some countries, this whole issue around the aging and demographic crisis, the future of the welfare state and healthcare, et cetera. So of course the state can't deliver if finance isn't doing its job and the business isn't doing its job. And then is the state then also doing its job, right? So I want to focus more on that for the rest of this talk. And they've given me 40 whole minutes, so hopefully you'll stay awake. I'll have to crack some jokes every now and then. So the state's problem, I believe, and we discussed this also last night at a lecture I gave at UTS where I kind of unpicked this whole graph here, which we'll spend less time on tonight, is that the way we framed the role of the public sector today, and literally also how we then train civil servants, is in terms of fixing problems when they happen. And you know, one of the biggest problems I've already just kind of mentioned in passing, the financial crisis, that had to be fixed, so all these banks were bailed out. Many industries were also bailed out. In the US, the whole auto industry was basically bailed out, and that was a big bandage that had to be brought in. But also in general, basically policymakers around the world, and I've had really interesting discussions with your own policymakers over the last 2 days, and they confirmed that they're basically not allowed to do anything until they actually identify the kind of screw-up that happens in the market. So what's the market failure that you're going to fix? And it's not that these different failures don't exist. So, you know, when you have public goods like basic research that the private sector doesn't invest in because the spillovers are so great, so they can't make a profit from it, that's why the state has to come in and do basic research. It is a market failure. Or when companies pollute too much because their cost structures don't actually embody the bad stuff that pollution does, so they need a carbon tax to make them embody that into their costs. Or when you have asymmetric information, et cetera, et cetera. This is actually a, in some ways, a powerful framework. It's useful, but it'd be very hard to use it to actually understand some of the biggest changes that have occurred and the role of the state within that change. And in the book, The Entrepreneurial State, I kind of went through the big technological changes that have occurred from the internet to aeronautics to mass production and today the clean technology sector. And I kind of go through why actually the state did much, much more than just fixing different types of market failures. And it's quite striking how then this language of fixing and mending and enabling and facilitating and de-risking, I always kind of start getting bored as I say it, is so powerful. I even find myself sometimes using it. We forget just how kind of lame and boring it is. Even, you know, central banks, which again kind of saved the capitalist system from completely falling apart after the financial crisis. Forget whether they did it right or wrong, but you know, it happened. They're seen as lenders of last resort, right? Again, kind of lame. When actually when you see these big investments that have occurred over time by different types of state structures, they were investors of first resort. But these words have become so powerful in sort of common parlance that they become part of the storytelling, part of the discourse, and then makes it really hard actually to allow the state to deliver in ambitious ways and also be a dynamic partner alongside these other actors. And of course, there's the great magazine The Economist that never fails to have their great editorial pieces, which make it just really clear how powerful this frame is, which is, you know, the state, yeah, of course, it's important, we're smarter than the Tea Party, but just kind of do your basic stuff. Invest in skills and infrastructure and roads and bridges, but then get the hell out of the way and let the revolutionaries do their thing, the value creators, the wealth creators. And this is so powerful that even the Labour Party in the UK, I found, started talking that way. When they lost the 2015 election, there was all this kind of like thought, well, how did we lose? And there was three different articles, I remember, Tony Blair, I think it was Rachel Reeves and Chukwuma, all in different ways kind of said the same thing. We lost because we didn't embrace the wealth creators. And I thought, a Labour Party using this word wealth creator in such a narrow way, because they were basically talking about business. And of course, business creates wealth, but so does labor. You're called the Labour Party. Workers create wealth. Different types of public institutions create wealth. But how can they create it? How can we actually structure these different organizations in such a way that they can really also challenge each other, which is just as important as addressing the challenges. Contested spaces are very important for creating value. Anyway, so this, sorry, I made this graph for my TED talk so many years ago that it took such a long time to make it that I have to put it up there to justify the effort. It was actually quite funny that the proper, you know, so this is real TED, not just TEDx, and they were so nervous that you kind of screw up your TED talk that they're always like, are you ready? Have you made your slides? would you like the Prezi team in San Francisco to make the slides for you? And I was like, all right, yeah, that kind of sounds cool. So the Prezi team in San Francisco basically made this funky Prezi thing for me, being guided, micromanaged, and this was one of the slides. Anyway, so this is supposed to show what basically we've been trained to think, that all the really interesting, you know, value creation is done in business by people like Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, and every country has their versions of that. And then you have these bureaucrats, right? This is a Kafkaian bureaucrat. And as I said last night, forget that Kafka is much cuter and handsome than Zuckerberg. You're supposed to think that the guys there on the left, or your left, yeah, my left too, are more sexy and interesting. So that, you know, it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, that the more we pretend that the state is about facilitating, de-risking, enabling, doing the horizontal conditions, shoving some papers here and there, getting the tax system right, setting the rules of the game, leveling, that's kind of what we end up getting. We end up getting this kind of black and white and sometimes a bit boring and inertial and bureaucratic structures that then we like to complain about and say that they're slow and bureaucratic. But it's like, yeah, well, that's what we basically told them that they were like. And so we just then have to pause a minute and say, how did we get there? Like, why do we have the self-fulfilling prophecy? And how can we get out of that precisely so the state can deliver and become a dynamic partner, also a thorn in the side of the other partners, which is one of the roles. You know, healthy marriages or partnerships are where you also challenge each other. You don't just say, what do you need? Let's be business friendly. Business, what would you like? Less tax, less regulation, okay. So how can we get healthy and symbiotic and mutualistic partnerships? I'm often reminded by my biologist friends, which are basically just two. I have, unfortunately, lots of lawyer friends, but the biologists are very interesting. And they often say, why do you always use this word ecosystem? You know, do you even know what you're talking about? I'm like, no, not really. They say, you know, do you mean predator-prey? Do you mean parasitic? Do you mean mutualistic? Do you mean symbiotic? You know, which ecosystem? And it's such a good point, because we often, especially in the policy arena, we hear this word partnership and ecosystems, entrepreneurial ecosystems, innovation ecosystems, and then forget to define them. Are we sure we haven't actually built a predator-prey ecosystem, a parasitic ecosystem? And how can we change that, even in terms of the contracts that, in fact, often structure these partnerships, how public and private interact? Just a quick example, Novartis, a big pharmaceutical company, today is working for free on the International Space Station. And patenting. You know, who thought about that? You know, where's the contract? How can that be that there's no sort of payback into this big publicly funded infrastructure, which does cost a lot of money for such a highly profitable company, which is using not just the infrastructure, but the time of the astronauts up there to do some of their research. And there's a very interesting story about that, how that happened, which I don't have time for. Anyway, so I often say, let's just pause a minute and just remind ourselves that, in fact, markets, the word market, which we often hear as well, is actually an outcome, right? Markets and business are not the same thing. The market is an outcome of the interactions between public and private and third sectors or civil society organizations and how those organizations are governed. So I just mentioned the shareholder maximization governance, but also how the public sector is governed, if it's just about fixing market failures or other things, and how these interactions are structured will actually define what kind of market outcomes we get. And markets, so they're built, they're designed, they're outcomes, which is, by the way, a great point. It should make us less depressed when we see what's happening out there, because it means we can actually change things. We can rethink how to design them in better ways. And so what I did in this book, and sorry, this is completely self-promotional, but it's kind of nice when your book is translated in lots of interesting languages, especially when in German they call it Das Kapital, because I don't think it's going to happen again, but Das Kapital des Staat, the capital of the state. It was actually interesting. I asked the German publisher, I was like, but that's not like a literal translation of the entrepreneurial state. They said, yeah, but you know, the progressives in Germany just don't really like the word entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial. And I kind of thought about that, because in Italian as well, that word doesn't mean what it actually means in English, which is welcoming of risk and uncertainty. It kind of makes you just think of some businesses which we call commercialisti, who just kind of try to avoid tax. But it was interesting. But I love the word Das Kapital des Staat, not only because it makes one think that maybe the book will have huge revolutionary impact, as Das Kapital did, but actually it's very clear. It's about the capital of the state. It starts making you think, oh, like a portfolio, investing, not just lender of last resort, investor first resort. And then difficult questions, well, what does that mean? What's the risk profile? What do we even mean by risk in the public sector versus risk in the private sector? And how might you distribute that risk along different types of, say, renewable technologies if you want a green transition? It may be going beyond the renewable energy sector and have a real green direction for the entire economy. Anyway, I started to really like that. But every other country decided not to go down that route. And anyway, and also if you read Carlo Polanyi, someone who really influenced me, he basically studied everything. He was a historian, anthropologist, sociologist. He reminds us in his great book, The Great Transformation, that in fact markets, how we use the word market, which is basically the capitalist national market, as opposed to international markets and local markets where you buy fruit and vegetables on the corner. Those international and local markets have actually been around for a long, long time, thousands of years. But the national capitalist market, which kind of gives us a sense of an average price of a kilo of oranges, was actually forced into existence from different types of policy making acts, which means that we should be careful when we even use the word, forget which side of the the political spectrum, but kind of policy as an intervention in the market is just historically wrong. The market itself, as I mentioned, is an outcome of all these different actors. So you're not intervening in the market, you're actually co-shaping and co-creating that market for the good or for the bad, whatever. But this idea that the market's just out there and you're intervening in it. Similarly, by the way, businesses, when you do criticize them, as I sometimes do, speaking to different business leaders who I often find myself talking to, and I say, why do you do all these share buybacks? Why not reinvest? And they say, yeah, you're right, you know. But hey, this short-termism is kind of being forced on us by the market, the market pressure. And I'm like, but hold on, that, you know, how you are behaving is actually determining the market. So this kind of this feedback loop and this tautological way that we think about markets. So it's really important to kind of unpick these words instead of just repeating them. So again, what I try to do in the entrepreneurial state is precisely unpick the kind of fallacy, one could say fake news, that we have in terms of where all this wealth came from. And again, that the Labour Party itself somehow was using the word wealth creator to mean entrepreneurs in places like Silicon Valley. And I won't go through that because it would take me a long time, but what I tried to do was really to use kind of history, especially in the US, but not only, to kind of show that, you know, many of these products that we think kind of came out of entrepreneurship, along with business, just kind of, sorry, states just doing basic things like infrastructure and some basic science here and there, actually would never have happened without the state taking massive risks through particular types of organizations. So this isn't just public money, which acted as, again, an investor first resort. In fact, in this case, in all the technology in your smart products, whether you have an iPad, an iPhone of any make, that make those products smart and not stupid. You know, people don't say, oh, sorry, let me talk to my idiotic phone, they talk about it as a smartphone. And everything that makes that phone smart was an outcome of a public investment that could have also gone wrong. So the internet, for every internet, there's also been many failures, and that was an investment made by a particular organization inside the public sector, DARPA. But the internet, GPS, touchscreen, Siri, and I could go on and on. Fracking itself came out of initially DOE investments in the US. And that, by the way, is a good reminder. This isn't a normative point, oh, the state did all this good stuff. No, but the state is transformational in that kind of Polanyi-esque kind of sense. So we should be having debates in society about, well, what is the state investing in? And there's this, again, feedback loop that because we dismiss the role of the state and its transformational power, its investment power, we sometimes also don't look at what's being invested in until maybe it's too late. So lots of debates that do exist about fracking and shale gas only happened after the fact. And few people also know that that came out of public investments. But, you know, in terms of this green transition, which so many countries are asking for, and one thing, by the way, I've learned over the last 2 days, it's amazing how much you can learn when you visit a country and CPD organizes your schedule and makes sure you have literally no time to do anything else but talk to all these interesting people, which has been fantastic, is learning just how much actually your population is demanding this green transition, that in some ways it's the policymakers that aren't, you know, if you want, acting up towards that challenge. But the people, apparently, from what I understand, are kind of demanding some concrete action. And this should be very encouraging news. But around the world, what we see is that the investments themselves, in terms of the renewable energy side of the green transition, and we shouldn't forget that it's not just about renewable energy, it's about greening the entire manufacturing sector, getting green services, having demand pull and supply push kind of investments. But just looking at renewable energy, what we see is a very similar pattern that we saw in biotech, in nanotech, the internet, that upper right-hand quadrant, high risk, high uncertainty, high capital intensity, is in fact being occupied by different types of public actors that we just then don't really understand because we, again, don't have the narrative and the discourse and the theory and the framework to understand it. So ironically, many public banks, for example, that are playing a leading role on the deployment and diffusion of renewable energy, like the KfW in Germany, the China Development Bank in China, the European Investment Bank, then ironically get sometimes told that they're crowding out business, they're being too active, too ambitious. You know, let the market decide the direction. You should just be providing counter-cyclical finance. And yet history shows us that actually no, business tends to only follow once the government actually plays this kind of lead investor role, creating both kind of certainty, which people like Nick Stern have long argued for, but also really leading in terms of these high-risk investments, which also are often long-term, patient, mission-oriented investments. In fact, the short-term investments create lots of trouble. venture capital, which, you know, is needed, but if it's structured problematically and very exit-driven, as it currently is, venture capitalists often want to exit in 3 to 5 years through an IPO or a buyout, can create problems, especially in areas that require that long-termism. So in the biotech sector, we've ended up with lots of PLEPOs, productless IPOs, because of the rush that was created. So, you know, finance isn't neutral. How do you actually structure finance in such a way that it really can nurture these processes, especially in science-based sectors? And people like Bill Gates have actually been quite forthcoming about this, unlike Peter Thiel, who sometimes, well, I don't know, if you listen to what he says, he says things like that the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley should secede off the coast because they are being impeded by the state and they shouldn't even have to produce, you know, pay tax because they're so valuable. Of course, until the tsunami comes and they'll call the Coast Guard. So, you know, I always say, yeah, go to the coast, but then stay there when the waves come. Or, you know, even worse, when they say, oh, if you increase that tax or impose that regulation, we're going to leave the country. I'm like, okay, I'll drive you to the airport. Just tell me where you want to go. You know, because in fact, the really interesting and ambitious businesses don't talk like that, and they know. Again, Bill Gates is very clear that both he and Steve Jobs surfed a massive wave of government investments, and he rightly is concerned that that wave today is not being created, so we just end up with a bunch of surfers, which literally in California they have. I think you do too, though. I saw that in the Bondi Beach. You have a lot of surfers. So what's interesting, I love this letter. It was actually much longer than this that Keynes wrote to Roosevelt, because he's kind of saying the same thing, but in a different way. And I think that modern Keynesians didn't really capture this. So they kind of bought into this idea that all you need is government in terms of being counter-cyclical, which is an important role. But this is more than that. He's saying, we got a problem here. You know, in business, it's not true that we have all these kind of lions and wolves and tigers and this kind of willingness to roar. That's why I have the lion and the pussycat in the front cover of the first version of The Entrepreneurial State. We've got a bunch of hamsters and gerbils and pussycats and, you know, domesticated animals. And he didn't mean it like a criticism. It wasn't like, gerbil. I think what he meant, and unfortunately this hasn't really been developed in much of his writings, was, well, we better understand better how to get the pussycat to roar, how to get these domestic animals to even want to invest. Right? This assumption that business wants to invest and you just have to get rid of the impediments, get rid of the tax, get rid of the regulation, and then they're going to invest is simply not true. It often has been ambitious and bold, directional, strategic, what I will soon call mission-oriented investments that got business to even see the opportunity for investment in the first place. And then a well-devised tax credit or something might affect the marginal contribution. But many countries, including, I would almost say especially, but that would be too exaggerated, Australia, over-rely on these indirect tax incentives. And it would only work if your business is already like super wanting to roar and you just have to kind of, you know, play around with the tax structure, whether it's an R&D tax credit or whatever, to make them invest more. But the evidence shows that there's very little additionality, that's what the word that economists use, with tax incentives. They don't make investment happen that wouldn't have happened anyway. What actually drives business investment is the expectations within the business sector in different parts of the private sector of where these future opportunities lie. And in fact, Warren Buffett, I usually have his quote up here, I forgot to add it because I already had too many slides. He often says, can you just stop reducing my tax? I don't even look at it. I invest when I see an opportunity, which doesn't mean that tax should go sort of out of the roof, but just to really understand, well, what is it then that drives these expectations in the business community of where these future opportunities lie? And that's exactly those kinds of public investments that I looked at in The Entrepreneurial State, which came, and again, all these different sectors, which really laid down the groundwork, the high-risk, early-stage investments, especially the capital-intensive ones, which then business was able to surf on. And this, again, just shows you that distribution of direct and indirect. So the indirect is the light blue. These are tax incentives that different countries might use to support business in their R&D decisions. And it tends to be that those countries that over-rely on the tax incentive and don't have enough of the direct kind of investment from the kind of DARPA-type institutions, but also strategic public banks or public venture capital funds like Yasma in Israel, then don't actually get up, you know, galvanize and catalyze the business community to invest. And so there's a strong relationship, or I shouldn't say completely correlated, but anyway, there's a strong correlation between countries that have high business spending on R&D, that's what BIRD stands for, relative to GDP, and those that actually also have a good distribution of both direct investments and then just kind of rely on the indirects just for a kind of icing on the cake, not the cake itself. And in Australia, it's quite actually worrying that both the over-reliance on indirects has also kind of is showing up, in fact, in terms of a falling BIRD ratio in terms of business spending. And this is, again, something that just really needs to be thought about in terms of, well, then what should happen in order to also, in terms of having a transition from an economy that has over-relied on natural resources and mining to one that actually, again, society is asking for a transition towards a green direction. What kind of policy toolkit? And this is why I then wrote this second book, The Value of Everything, because what I found was in my kind of travels around the world speaking to policymakers who were quite thirsty for this new narrative and framework about market co-shaping, market co-creating, is that even those that kind of agreed with it, like, oh yeah, wow, that's really interesting, you know, that Silicon Valley wasn't just entrepreneurs. I guess that does mean that we need to, you know, have a whole set of different tools across the whole innovation chain, supply side, demand side, patient capital, basic research, applied research, institutions that really facilitate the feedback between science and industry, that then the actual instruments that they devised were often kind of problematic. And when you looked at why they came about, like the patent box, which you should be congratulated as a country for not having introduced it, I'll say what it is in just a minute, were lobbied for by companies in the name of innovation, in the name of value creation, in the name of wealth creation. So I wrote this new book, which really just kind of unpicked that word value. Just quickly, the patent box is this tax reduction on profits earned through areas that have patents, right, intellectual property rights, which makes no sense because a patent is already a monopoly for 20 years. So there's no reason to reduce the tax on monopoly profits. And it's very interesting how the pharmaceutical industry really lobbied that through. And if you look at the way it did it, it was very much in terms of value and innovation. And so many countries, even those that have had these kind of direct public investments, kind of just bought into that due to this very strong discourse. Similarly, I mentioned before, I think, Warren Buffett, yes, I did, the particular tax he was complaining about that was just getting too low. You know, you need Warren Buffett to say, stop producing my tax, was a capital gains tax, which in the U.S. dropped by 50% in 4 years in the 1970s. And he rightly says, you know, all that led to was kind of, you know, higher inequality, didn't actually increase investment. And that was lobbied for very specifically by the National Venture Capital Association that basically had just organized itself as an organization of VCs who then made it their kind of big lobbying effort and succeeded to get that tax down. So I was very taken, again, as I mentioned, by both how the Labor Party talks and just kind of this commonplace assumption that, you know, the state doesn't create value, it can at best facilitate it. Where did these ideas come from? And it was very interesting that in the history of economic thought, this was kind of at the core of how economists kind of also debated between themselves. So the physiocrats in the 1700s thought that value came out of farm labor. They were very worried about all the value that they saw as being siphoned out of the system by the landlords, who they called the sterile class. The classical economists, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and Karl Marx, had a different understanding. They thought that value was very much in industrial labor. So Adam Smith wrote this whole book called The Wealth of Nations, where he really unpicked what was happening with the division of labor inside the factories of the time, the effect on productivity, the effect on growth, and hence the wealth of nations. And he was very worried about, again, a value being siphoned out in terms of rent, the power of the landlords also at the time, but not only. And he talked about his unearned income. And again, Marx also very much thought that way. But what then happened was, and I go through this very, very laboriously in the book, through these 400 years, is that then this huge revolution happened in neoclassical economics, that this attention in the previous economists to the objective conditions of production that determined their understanding of value, whether it was farm labor, industrial labor, but this focus also on technological change, the division of labor, productivity, all of a sudden became this more subjective focus on basically prices and supply and demand curves and preferences. So even wages were understood no longer in terms of the objective class struggle and labor's bargaining power, but in terms of preferences for leisure versus work. So lots of attention on the individual. Now, I'm not going to go through all that, because that's a whole long lecture to tell you about this book on value, but it relates back to this issue of the state and can the state deliver. Because if the state itself can't be understood, even in terms of productivity, then how is it going to be able to also guide its investments and think of itself as valuable? And what's interesting with government is, whereas someone like Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, was able to, with a straight face after 1 year of the crisis, say, Goldman Sachs workers are the most productive in the world, because basically, I forgot to say, this focus on subjectivity and preferences is basically a theory of price, which determines our theory of value, versus what the previous economists did, which is they had a theory of value, which determined a theory of price. The government, even if it wanted to, can't do that, because the way we actually account for government activities in GDP is only through the costs of the activity. So we don't actually have a measure for the value of the education system, of the health system, which of course can be structured in all sorts of different ways, because in many countries, those things are free, so we only know how to calculate the costs, say the salaries of the teachers, that goes in. So in terms of output per labor, if you don't know how to value the output of what government does, you literally can't account for its productivity. But this also, again, as I mentioned before, has very much, you know, this is actually wed into how we think about the policymaking process itself in terms of just fixing market failures. And public choice theory, which is a whole kind of strong apparatus that has been used to train civil servants around the world, also has very clearly kind of delineated those spaces where the public sector is allowed to tread and those where it's not, because if it goes anywhere beyond that, it's going to be a risk of getting captured and corrupted, to the point that many civil servants have actually been trained to think that government failure is even worse than market failure. So yes, correct those things, but just, you know, occupy as little space as possible. I see this, by the way, all the time with every year or every couple of years when the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, gets evaluated by the Treasury, it's told it's crowding out, right? It's fine to do documentaries about giraffes in Africa. It's fine to do high-quality news. But you can't do soap operas and talk shows. You know, that's for business. So this idea that there's only, I'm Italian, so I think of pizzas, you know, there's a slice of the pizza, a slice of the market that is okay for the business sector to operate in, another slice that's okay for the government sector, kind of shows that we don't actually have a concept of public value, so that independent of the format, how you're actually creating value matters and the processes in place, which instead are very pertinent and very important and highlighted all the time for the business sector, which of course we know does create value. And so that's why you have CEOs and managers all over the world attending top business schools and taking these really cool courses like strategic management, organizational behavior, decision sciences, and they're told to take risks. And, you know, Steve Jobs had this great lecture to the Stanford graduating class. He said, be hungry, be foolish if you want to innovate. You know, have you ever heard a civil servant being told, be hungry, be foolish, be nutty, make mistakes, and then get up and learn again, like Zuckerberg proudly said until more recently, where he's been under more attack. But anyway, this is just common parlance, right? Venture capitalists are actually proud to say how many times they failed, because then they say, and then I succeeded. And instead, again, all these words that I began with are just so boring, and they, of course, fear failure. If you fail in the public sector, bang, you're on the front page of the news, and you are told, you know, why were you trying to do anything more than these horizontal conditions? Recently in the U.S., this came up in terms of the Solyndra investment, you know, this investment in a solar company that Obama, through the Department of Energy, gave $500 million in terms of a guaranteed loan, and it failed, and everyone's like, ah, again, like the Concorde, stop. Government's stupid. You shouldn't invest. Just do the bridges and the roads and the skills, and then get the hell out of the way. And then we got a problem, right? If you want to get the hell out of the way, throw your iPhone away, because it would not be a smartphone, because those were strategic choices in all those different technologies. But also the same amount of money went to Tesla. Tesla got the same amount of money, just a bit less than Solyndra. Huge success up until he started tweeting. I've actually started doing some problematic tweets. So I shouldn't. Anyway, Twitter can completely bring people down. So, but anyway, Elon Musk, before he tweeted and smoked a bit, was seen as a success, right? But the normal person in the U.S. doesn't realize that not only did one of his main companies, Tesla, get the same amount of money as Solyndra, but he also himself, the first three companies, including SpaceX and SolarCity, got $5 billion from the U.S. government, right? So again, if the government actually understands itself as das Kapital des Staat, the portfolio of the state, it should also really be able to talk about that much better, so people also understand that this is hard. To have a green transition, you will be needing to provide that patient long-term capital, especially in the early stage, for different companies, not just the basic research, but for the few companies willing to innovate to get us these transitions. And yes, that might sometimes end in a failure. But the next question should be, well, you know, how do you also make sure that you're not just subsidizing and bailing out the failures, but perhaps getting some of the upside from the successes? And it was quite interesting that Obama, in the Tesla example, said the exact opposite of what he should have. He said, if you don't pay back the loan, we get 3 million shares in your company. And Elon was probably like, yeah, okay. What he should have said, if you're successful, we get 3 million shares in your company. And in fact, the price per share went from 9 to 90 in that period, which would have more than paid back the Solyndra loss if multiplied by 3 million and the next round. Anyway, we don't think like that. And this is why also Obama here, looking very sad, looking outside of the window, was very right when he said, we actually live and do business in the information age, the knowledge economy, but the last major reorganization of the government happened in the age of black and white TV. And he's absolutely right, but this isn't a coincidence. We have this incredibly ideological apparatus, even in civilized countries like Australia, where you don't have something like the Tea Party. You know, so many countries are just so wed to this understanding of this kind of limited role of what the public sector is for. And so we also don't have a rigorous way to talk about value as being collectively created, even though some illuminated business people like Buffett and Bill Gates will actually, you know, sit down and say, well, actually, we would not have made the money we did without this amazing structure behind this. And that's why then, again, for me, it was very important to unpick this notion of value and to suggest that basically it'll be impossible to actually address these big changes that we have ahead unless we also see it as collectively creating the value. And literally, this should start changing the way we talk. You know, all those words that I said were really lame and bureaucratic, and boring. And this is just some postcards that I send out to friends and family from the institute that I direct, just trying to get people to talk differently. And this institute that I, again, set up at UCL, which is a proper department, one of the main things we're trying to do is actually set up a whole new training program for global public servants to really be trained outside of this public choice, new public management box, which is very much part of the problem, and to unpick this word public value. What is it? You know, what is it? How could it be that the BBC has had this discussion about public value for so many years, and yet economists, we don't even have that word in our toolbox. It is in business schools, but business schools, as we know, say, do a lot of fluffy, flaky things with little academic rigor. Just kidding. How many? Okay. Actually, I'm not kidding. But anyway, we can talk about that later. So I've gone over time. I just want to give you just a bit of an inkling of what I've been doing in some recent years, or the last 12 months, actually, with the European Commission, which was really to say, how can we operationalize this idea about collective value creation? And for me, it was about kind of asking a really practical question, but it's actually quite philosophical, which is, how do we get to the moon? I mean, how can it be that we can't kind of, you know, get our hospitals working properly, and yet we got up there? You know, that's pretty hard. Sometimes I'm in the middle of traffic in London. I'm like, how can it be we got to the moon and we can't structure London traffic, right? So what got us to the moon, and again, I have completely run out of time, so this is going to be super quick. You'll have to invite me back just to do a talk on missions. But I did give a long talk last night on missions, and they told me to diversify tonight, so it's partly their fault. So, you know, there was a very inspirational goal. It was addressing a challenge. The challenge was not going to the moon. The challenge was the space race and beating the Russians and the whole Sputnik thing. But getting to the moon and back again in a generation was concrete. It was targeted. You can actually answer, yes or no, did you get there? Forget that there's some weirdos that actually think we never got there. And there's a relationship with who, well, I won't talk about Brexit, but anyway. No, it's interesting, actually, the whole, like, skeptics of experts, what they think. And lots of different sectors across the economy had to invest. You could not get to the moon in jeans and a T-shirt eating a hot dog, right? There were specific types of clothing and textiles had to innovate. Specific types of food had to innovate. Of course, it was also a big aeronautics experiment. Then lots of different projects, of which most failed. We know the successful ones, because again, a lot of those projects ended up in our smart products. But you know, what would it look like if we did the same thing around missions to address climate change? The different types of sectors that would need to invest, and using the full gamut of government instruments, from procurement to prize schemes to grants, not just to, as an old colleague of mine said, well, it's a technical word, pissing in the wind. But and I know it sounds rough, but he's a very famous innovation economist who passed away, Keith Pavitt. What he meant was just kind of spreading out support to, you know, the SMEs or particular sectors, but actually rewarding those organizations that are willing to engage with government with these difficult missions. So using procurement and prize schemes to really welcome bottom-up those organizations willing to invest. And instead of just talking about clean oceans, which of course was a huge issue, and if you watch Blue Planet, David Attenborough's wonderful series, the last episode, all this plastic in the oceans, what would it look like also internationally to really go after that problem and make, you know, using, again, the full gamut of government instruments, but also rewarding those companies that are willing to co-invest in that project and using, you know, again, across lots of different sectors, as opposed to seeing it just as in terms of getting plastic out. It would require lots of different innovations and investments in terms of what goes in the first place. And what this report that I wrote did, which has now actually become part of the legal framework for the European Commission, was also to kind of unpick what does it mean to pick a mission and to be sure that it's bold and inspirational and perhaps really try to get lots of different parts of civil society engaged in defining that mission in the first place, which is a bit different from the moonshot, because that was very top-down by Kennedy and his team. In Germany today, the Energiewende mission has very much come out of also the green movement fighting for that. And again, in Australia, amazing that citizens are so concerned with it. How can we actually devise democratic and stakeholder engagement to define these missions in the first place, but to make sure that they will also be designed in such a way that requires that cross-sectoral, cross-actor, cross-disciplinary investment. And just to say that, you know, the missions in the past required particular types of organizational capacity and this kind of outsourcing of knowledge and capabilities within these state structures, which, as I said, was a feedback, kind of self-fulfilling prophecy from this public choice, new public management view of the world. In fact, how to design the organizations themselves to be mission-oriented. And it's quite striking, if you just look at their websites of many of these that have been very impactful, they never describe themselves as just fixing markets. But if we don't understand what it means to have a mission and to see and test whether that variable, if you want, is important on our economic models, it doesn't, in fact, exist. We don't capture missions in how we think about the economy. I don't really have time to talk about this, but just to say that, you know, this can also really frame how you do your industrial strategy instead of handing out money, focusing on challenges. We have a commission at UCL that I chair, co-chair with David Willits, which kind of breaks down these challenges around clean growth, future mobility, and kind of what we've been doing in terms of this big commission we have and also engagement with stakeholders is what would it look like to really address the future of mobility with a concrete mission that would, you know, include having a public infrastructure, public transport system, which was 100% accessible by people with disabilities. That would be one of the sort of bottom-up projects. So let me just skip ahead. What's the answer to the question, can the state deliver? Yes, it can, but only if we really change the way we think, the way we talk about the state, the way we train our public servants, and also the way that we also get proper deals. This is not just about de-risking, it's sharing risks and rewards. And that Tesla example of how things kind of got a bit strange of thinking that you would only bail it out if things went wrong, how can we really rethink the contract? So, co-creating value, not just enabling it, market co-shaping, not just fixing, investor first resort, not just lender of last resort, but also really creating interesting spaces where these debates can be had, where we can contest value, where we can actually, you know, talk about why is it that it's so easy for, again, Goldman Sachs to talk about itself as a value creator, just so difficult for a teacher or a nurse to feel the confidence and the happiness of this amazing value that, of course, they create, but we have no clue how to capture that and hence have a difficulty in nurturing it as well. And I am done, and I am 5 minutes over time, but I'm sure that's okay.